Hello everyone, my name is Naved Romi. I'm the director of IVP, Israel Victory Project in Israel. Today we are very honored to have a former ambassador, Ellen Baker, here with us for this webinar. I will give a short brief about Ambassador Baker's resume, and then we will continue with our very interesting conversation. So Ambassador Baker is one of Israel's prominent experts in international law. He served for 10 years as the legal advisor of Israel's foreign ministry, followed by a 4-year term as ambassador of Israel to Canada. He was previously seconded to the UN as a senior legal advisor to the organization. He participated in the peace process negotiations with all Israel Arab neighbors, as well as in the drafting of the various peace treaties and other agreements. He also represented Israel in negotiations in the UN on various international treaties, including the various international conventions dealing with international terror. He has drafted international instruments regarding suicide terror and incitement to terror. He has published an extensive series of articles on various aspects of the Middle East peace process, as well as on international law issues such as terror, the ICC, humanitarian law, and human rights law. I also highly recommended to read his last article in JNS about the incident with Ben and Jerry's. He is presently the director of the International Law Program at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. He also has an independent law practice and a member of Miftachi, an organization of retired officers of the Israel Defense Force, diplomats, and civil legal advisors. Hello, Mr. Baker.
Hi, good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you for being here with us this evening. And I told you before when we spoke before that I'm going to speak with you about the BDS, but as you said yourself, this issue can develop to many other terms, to many other aspects. We can go from this issue to speak about terms like ethnic cleansing and the occupied Palestinian territories, and even about some figures in the Democrat Party in the United, in the White House, which somehow all these issues can connect. As I said, you have a long and very impressive resume that can give us a very interesting light on all of these topics, but I will continue with maybe the most basic question. Can you give us an explanation about the BDS? When did it started? Why it began, and why it is so unique compared to other battles against Israel?
Okay, well, look, Naveh, first of all, I think the fact that we're devoting nominally this discussion to the issue of BDS is paying too greater a compliment to the effect of the BDS and its importance, because in actual fact, apart from the hype behind it, it has minimal effect on Israel's economy and on Israel's social scene. It makes a lot of noise, especially in light of the recent issue with Ben and Jerry's. But the mere fact that we are turning it into a major discussion is exactly what the BDS people are looking for. They're trying to extend and magnify their effect far greater than their effect really is. But to answer your question, I think it probably really began at the Durban conference in 2001, September, I think it was 2001. I attended the conference, a very nasty affair, very difficult, very depressing. But it was there that there were two wings to the conference, a governmental or a state conference between delegations of states and a NGO, a non-governmental organization wing, with all the various NGOs. And it was this NGO forum that adopted basically a series of resolutions and recommendations and plans of action to boycott Israel, to sanction Israel, to punish Israel, and to determine that Israel is an apartheid state, an ethnic cleansing state, and all the various buzzwords that the international society has come to accept, they were stuck to Israel at the Durban conference. It's interesting that we're coming up now to the 20th anniversary of that conference, and several states have already informed the UN organizers that they're going to boycott it because it's a political conference.
Okay, I will just say that our guests here are welcome to send questions, and I will try to transfer the questions, most of them, if it will be possible to you. But I want to ask you something, because you said something very interesting. I think most people are forgetting about the Durban conference, which many people, even as I remember, call it anti-Semite conference. Do you believe it was anti-Semite in certain ways?
Absolutely. Look, there's no doubt about it. We have to accept, and we can't deny the fact that whatever's happening today, whether it's the BDS or Ben and Jerry's or all the various UN resolutions bashing Israel or other organizations, UNESCO, all these, the Democratic Party in the US, these various Congress women who seem to have taken the lead in trying to harm Israel, you can't divorce all this from the element of anti-Semitism that exists there. Because bashing Israel and singling out Israel, apart from all other states in the world, and there are countries that are carrying out the most inhumane actions against their own population that are unthinkable, but nobody's talking about them. And so the mere fact of singling out the Jewish state is basically in and of itself an act of anti-Semitism, no less than singling out the Jew in a particular state. So we can't deny this. Now, Durban started this ball rolling. I had long discussions with Mary Robinson, who was the president of the Durban conference, and the Secretary General of the UN also, trying to warn them that look at what's happening, and nothing really helped. And I found myself sitting in the same row as people like Yasser Arafat and others who openly made speeches calling Israel an apartheid state. So this was really the beginning of the whole thing.
There is a question here that repeats itself from several people about what you just described, that's going on in campuses in the United States. Somehow the universities and the campuses became an area where the Israeli and the Palestinian conflict gets a lot of attention. And then unfortunately, many times we can hear some extreme voices using the words that you said against Israel, ethnic cleansing and apartheid state. How can you explain this? And also, is there anything Israel can do to try and fight it?
Look, the campuses always have been a center for radicalism, for radical thinking, for radical advocacy. It's nothing new. And especially today, when the Palestinians are being portrayed in the international community, and especially in international media, and especially among hostile elements, as the poor underdogs that they're doing nothing. Israel wakes up in the morning and decides to bomb them, and for no reason at all. This is the food that they're being fed, and this is what molds their position. When I was ambassador to Canada a few years ago, the Israel Apartheid Week began at the University of Toronto, and since it spread throughout the whole of North America. And I invited myself to speak at the week. I was warned by the Israeli Foreign Ministry, no, you shouldn't do this. You'll get attacked and it's dangerous and one thing and another. But I insisted, and the message that basically I came with was, look, you people don't understand what apartheid is and you don't understand what Israel is. And somebody has to explain to you what these two phrases are so that you will understand that you don't know what you're talking about. And in my opinion, this is the only way that we can deal with all this. These various movements on campus have to be dealt with face on by the individual Jewish communities. And it's not just a matter for the Israeli ambassador or the Israeli ambassadors, the Israeli representatives, because they're considered to be biased, funnily enough. The local community, Jews and non-Jews, need to be able to come out and speak out, including academic staff and others. And unfortunately, too many academic staff are afraid of their own jobs, and they're afraid to come out and say what needs to be said. I'm happy to see that the Jewish students organizations are doing this, but I think Jewish communities throughout North America especially, but also Europe, need to give the backing and support and to acquire the information necessary in order to help the students. This is what I'm trying to do from Israel, to provide the reasoning, to provide the legal answers, to provide answers to the various questions so that these people can face the accusers on campus.
There is a question here. I will try to phrase it. It slipped away, but I will ask it. How would you do the difference between, you talked about anti-Semitism and the Durban conference, but where is the line between anti-Semitism to a criticism that someone wants to say about Israel?
Okay, look, this is the classical question that today is to the attention of everybody. We've got this working definition of anti-Semitism by the International Holocaust Remembrance Association, I think that's the name, IHRA, which basically connects between classical anti-Semitism and the form of anti-Semitism of singling out Israel as the Jewish country among the other countries. Now this is a non-binding definition. It's not a perfect definition. They had to find the lowest common denominator that everybody would accept. So it's not binding, it hasn't got any teeth. A lot of countries have agreed to identify with it, but these same countries still vote against Israel in some of the most disgusting resolutions in the United Nations, and their parliaments and their leaders still come out against Israel, accusing Israel of doing all sorts of things that they know aren't true, but they're jumping onto the bandwagon. So it's very important now to try and face those countries that have agreed to acknowledge and identify with this definition of anti-Semitism, and to ask them to implement their commitment or their identification, and not just to pay lip service and then go ahead and participate in votes against Israel on resolutions that are blatantly untrue, blatantly false. But they know this, but nevertheless, for their own political interests, for their own economic interests, they go along with it.
You've been also a legal advisor in a very high profile legal advisor. What do you think is the best way to defeat Hamas? Is it agreements to come to some I don't know how to call it legal agreements? Is an army defeat? How should we handle this organization?
Look, Hamas is the organization that won the elections in the Gaza Strip. It's part of the Palestinian leadership. It's not a joint leadership because they're at loggerheads with the Palestinian Authority, with Fatah. So you can't say it's a unified leadership, but it exists. It represents a considerable percentage of the population of the Gaza Strip. It's not just a terrorist organization. It's an organization that has its own social and economic and educational infrastructure. So it's not something that you can just get rid of either, in my opinion, militarily or otherwise. It exists and it represents a growing trend among the fanatical Islamic elements, which are growing and increasing. That should be of concern to everybody. So how do you deal with it? I remember when I was ambassador in Canada, a lot of Canadian parliamentarians said, well, why can't you people just come to an agreement with Hamas, like you came to an agreement with the Palestinian, with the PLO? And my answer was, look at the philosophy of Hamas. The basic philosophy of Hamas, which is the basic Islamic philosophy, is that there's no room for any non-Muslim in the area, whether it's a Jew, a Christian, or anybody else. They're infidels, and they always were infidels, and they still consider themselves to be the infidel. And so the only way to get rid of them, according to the Hamas charter, is to fight and to destroy them and to throw them out. So to try and negotiate with that type of philosophy is like negotiating with God. That's their Bible, that's their creed, and they can't change this. It's part of what they view as the what Muhammad bequeathed Islam. So therefore, the only way to deal with it is how, if it's possible at all, to come to some type of modus vivendi. I can't see any chance of their joining any type of peace process, because the whole concept of peace with the Jewish state is something that they can't fathom. But acknowledging the fact that they can't get rid of us and they can't defeat us, so they're going to have to somehow live with us. And this is probably the way, if at all, that it might eventually be possible, if they get a pragmatic leadership that's prepared and capable and has the following, the public following, to do this.
I'm going back a bit because it's the second time I see this question. How do you explain the fact that some of the anti-Semit profile or shapes that you gave an example for before are being used by people in the Jewish community or sometimes by even Jewish organizations?
Well, Leo, this is, again, something that's very upsetting. I often find myself, when I'm giving talks and lectures, especially in North America or in Europe, that the most difficult people attacking me are Jews. It's probably some type of identification of elements within the Jewish community with their hosts, with the trend, the public trend to criticize Israel. Also, we're talking about a new generation, the old generation of pro-Israel Jews is being replaced by a new generation of young people who don't have the same roots, they don't have the same family roots, they don't have the same educational roots, and they take up the trending viewpoints that happen to exist within a particular country or state or community, and they take this up and they feel that because they're Jewish, they have to be all the more persistent and all the more vocal in doing this. And it's very depressing. And I personally call these people self-hating Jews. And I think one of the U.S. senators is, in my view, a typical example of this. The guy Bernie Sanders from Vermont, who's influenced Ben and Jerry's, and I think this is that there's a lot of, maybe not self-hating, but Jews who want to prove their identification with the local trends going on. And if the local trend is to criticize Israel and to attack Israel, then they'll go along with that. It's sad, but it's a fact that we have to deal with. And the only way we can deal with it, exactly as I said before, through educating them, through explaining to them, through answering questions, explaining why the basics that they're being fed, the terms such as occupied Palestinian territory, is a false term. Ethnic cleansing, it's untrue. Apartheid, it's not untrue. It's not understood. The whole concept of Israel isn't understood by these people, and they need to be. It needs to be explained to them, because they're lacking these basic facts, and they very easily tack on to any trend that happens to be popular.
Can you try to address, I know it's a complicated question, but can you try to address the legal issues relating to Jewish settlements in Judea and Samaria? For example, I know there are people saying that Judea and Samaria is an apartheid state, but Israel inside the 67 lines is not an apartheid. So can you try in a short way to try and explain the legal issue of this area?
How do we have 4, 5, 6 hours at our disposal? Look, in 1967, Israel entered the territories, okay? Israel, apart from extending its law to Eastern Jerusalem, the rest of the territories remain administered by Israel. There are those who call it occupied territory. Legally, the term occupation is a term that's become politicized, but it's a term that stems from the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. And I don't want to be overly legalistic, but that refers to a country which takes territory of another country during the course of a war. This didn't happen in our case, because the West Bank and the Gaza Strip were never Jordanian sovereign territory or Egyptian sovereign territory. So there was never a situation that can be defined as occupation. The same with the term Palestinian. These areas have never been Palestinian. There's never been a Palestinian state. There's never been any international declaration, determination, resolution, or treaty or convention that determines that the territories are Palestinian. So therefore the whole term occupied Palestinian territory is a false term. It doesn't exist. And the Palestinians themselves have agreed in the Oslo Accords that the final status, the permanent status of the territories, is a negotiating issue with Israel. And this negotiation has yet to be completed. So the whole issue of the status of the territories is still open. Now, according to international law, a country that administers territory has the prerogative to administer land as long as it's not privately owned. Now, all Israel's settlements are on public land which is not privately owned. Settlement on private land is absolutely prohibited. And I was a member of a governmental committee in Israel, the Edmond Levy Committee, that examined this, and we determined that nobody is allowed to build a settlement on territory which is privately owned, on land which is privately owned by local Arab residents. And there's a complicated legal procedure that one has to go through to prove that you that the land isn't privately owned. And so anybody who claims that the Israeli settlement activity is illegal, again, doesn't fully understand the legal situation. A lot of people claim that the Geneva Convention prohibits the forced transfer of population into occupied territory. But first of all, Israel hasn't indulged in forced transfer. This whole provision of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949 was drafted in order to prevent what the Nazis did of mass transfer, forced transfer of populations. And this isn't what Israel has been doing. I live in a settlement. I'm signed onto a contract with the Israeli government that everything is subject to the outcome of negotiations between the Israel and the Palestinians. So no Israeli settlement except on land that was previously owned by Jews, like in Hebron or various other places, no Israeli settlement has any permanent status pending the outcome of negotiations. So these whole buzzwords of illegal settlement, occupied Palestinian territory, and these various other things, they're false expressions that are simply being bandied about in order to bash Israel without any basic legal understanding of the situation. I'm sorry for a long answer, but these are very it's a very complicated question, but this has to be explained to these people. As I said before, all these things need to be answered, and the answers exist. And let me just refer to the website of the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, jcpa.org, and I have several papers that I've written there which respond to all these questions. And in fact, there are two papers. One is called 10 False Assumptions Regarding Israel, Answering These Questions, and Debunking 11 More False Assumptions. And I attack all these various assumptions and give brief, to the point responses. And it's well worthwhile going into that website and pulling down these answers, because they're very useful.
Ambassador Ellen Baker, the time flew by. I wanted to give you more time to summarize, but even this time we have only left with 2 minutes, and I have to apologize to all the people that asked so many questions, and I just didn't have the time to ask all of them. I want to thank you for the time you've been with us. Do you want to say something to summarize this webinar? Something that you want to emphasize?
Well, I think the main message that I've tried to pass on is the need to educate, the need to acquire the answers to the questions in order to pass them on, whether it's to the campuses or whether it's to the communities, Jewish communities, non-Jewish communities, churches, mosques, in order to provide the real answers, genuine answers, and not to be not to enable false accusations and allegations to be accepted and to be magnified. I think this is the main message, and this is the vital thing. This is what I'm trying to do in the Jerusalem Center. This is what I've tried to do during my period as ambassador and as legal advisor of the Israel's foreign ministry. Anytime you want to come back and have a further chat, I'll be very happy.
Thank you very much, former Ambassador Ellen Baker. It was a pleasure to have you with us. Here in Israel, it's tonight. In the States, it's noon. So it's been a pleasure in both times. Thank you for your time. And I thank all our guests today. And as Ambassador Baker said, I'm sure that we'll have more opportunities to host him here with us. Thank you all.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.